Hi there, I'm Stephen T. Lloyd, and welcome to part four of my introductory series to the STL. If you watched part one, we saw an overview of C++'s standard template library, and in particular its sequence containers, vector and dec and list and forward list. In part two, we saw the associative containers, map, set, multi-map, multi-set, and a little bit of the hash versions. And in part three, we saw its smart pointers, shared pointer, unique pointer. Saw a little bit about exception safety, and at the end of part three, I gave you a challenge. That is to take the puzzle Narukabi, here I've got the Wikipedia page about it, and to write a solver for it using the STL. This is a puzzle published by the same company that popularized Sudoku, which you've probably heard of, and it's actually quite challenging to write a program to solve. So I went and wrote a program that's about 40 kilobytes of source code, to solve this using all of the things that we saw in parts 1, 2, and 3. So if you're not familiar with what I just mentioned, go back and watch those parts. But if you've seen them, or if you've already been familiar with those parts of the STL, then let's jump right in and take a look at this code. It turns out that I had to use a whole bunch of things from the STL, including some things that I haven't talked about yet, and it'll be nice to actually see them in action. So, a definite prerequisite for this is reading the Wikipedia page about the puzzle, because in order to understand what a program does, you need to understand the problem domain that it's working in. In this case, it means understanding what it means to solve this puzzle. So I'm going to assume that you already know what I'm talking about when I talk about complete islands and pools and that sort of thing. The pages are very helpful. So my solver, what it does is it starts with this grid of numbers and attempts to apply a sequence of rules. The rules range from very simple to quite complicated. And every time it runs a rule, it tries to see if it can determine whether a cell is black or white. If it can, it marks that cell accordingly and then reruns the rules, trying to see if that has opened up any new avenues. Now, this is only one way to write a solver. There is another way to write a solver, and that is to take the grid, and here I've got a grid. You could guess that, oh, I'm going to guess that this cell is white, and then proceed trying to look for contradictions, and then maybe you'll have to guess that this cell is black, and then you'll proceed some more. That's why I refer to it as a backtracking solver, and my program does a little bit of that. It'll guess one cell and then try to see what it can prove from that. But what it will never do, as I've written it, is to try to guess two cells in sequence. I've written my program to solve the Narukabi puzzle like a human does. And if you read the Wikipedia page, it mentions that puzzles intended to be solved by humans usually do not require multiple guessing. They can be solved forward by proving that cells are white or black. As a little bit of CS fun, the puzzle can actually be proved to be NP-complete. That means that, in general, huge puzzles do require this backtracking, and they cannot be solved in polynomial time, which means that they can be incredibly difficult to solve. My solver is oriented towards solving the sort of puzzles that humans will do. Now, with a small change to the code, I could make it fully backtracking. I haven't done that because it doesn't interest me so much, but you could certainly take the code and modify it and see what happens when you do that. So let's start looking at the code. Here we go. Got it in VS 2010. I make liberal use of C++ constructs like auto and a bunch of STL algorithms. So if you try to compile this in Visual Studio 2008, it will not compile. I suggest that you upgrade. Of course, it can be translated back into the original C++ 9803 version that 2008 and previous compilers supported. But using the new OX constructs actually simplifies code significantly and makes it easier to understand rather than the reverse. So at the top of my source file, I've got the compiler command line. In this case, I compile it from the command line. You could, of course, build this in Visual Studio, the IDE. I compile it with maximum optimizations because we're going to look at its performance. And then I run the program, and then it emits HTML. And if I simply mention the output's file name, I'll open it up in my default browser, and I can look at what it is proving in a very convenient format. Initially, when I wrote this, I had it just printing out text to the console, but then I started getting fancy, and I eventually added the HTML here. So let's take a look at the main function of my program. Of course, I start off with a bunch of includes because I'm using so many components from the STL. As I think I mentioned in an earlier part, when you're using things from the STL, you should be careful to include all of the headers that you need. For example, if you're using helpers from the iterator header, you should include the iterator header directly and should not assume that any STL header is going to drag that in for you. In practice, many headers do, but according to the standard, that can change at any time. And in 2010, we went and changed how our headers include each other. In particular, we made algorithm stop including iterator. So users who assumed that the algorithm header would always drag in, the iterator header were broken. And that's a good change because it allows us to minimize our dependencies. But it will break you if you're not careful to include all the headers that you need. Fortunately, even if you mess up, going and dragging in the right header is a very easy change. So I include a bunch of headers from the STL. And because this is a source file, I say using namespace std. If this were a header, I would be playing by different rules. And because I could not pollute all of my users with a using directive, I would be using std double colon qualification. But since this is a source file, it's a CPP, I can make my code shorter. I disable the warning at the top with a comment. I'm going to use a C++ OX feature, explicitly specified underlying types on enumerations. Currently, 2010 will warn about this, saying, whoa, you're using a non-standard extension. That's actually no longer accurate. This underlying type extension was incorporated into C++ OX. Because it's official, I can disable this warning in my source file and go ahead and use the feature. We'll be fixing that, hopefully, in the next version of Visual Studio. So I've got a class, I call it Grid, that both stores the state of the puzzle that I'm working on, in addition to the initial state, which is all of these numbers, whether I've proven cells to be black or white. And it also stores extra bookkeeping, what I call regions, that help my analysis greatly. So we'll see how to do that. My interface is very simple. I've got a constructor that takes a width and a height, and then a string, which allows me to fill in the cells of the puzzle. Then I have a solve member function that, when you call it, it will go run its analysis, and it will return you a status code saying one of four things. Usually it says keep going, meaning I need to be called again because I've got more analysis to run. It can also say, oh, I found a solution, which is great, solution found. It could also say that it's found a contradiction. This means that we've marked cells in the grid that do not satisfy the rules of the Nurikabi puzzle. For example, if we ever mark four cells to be black in a square, that is not a valid solution. So if grid detects this, it'll return contradiction found. Now, of course, if we start off with a well-formed puzzle, we never expect contradiction found to be returned from the grid solver. But this definitely can happen if we start making these hypothetical guesses. What if I marked this cell to be black and then see what would happen? Maybe we will run into a contradiction. Of course, programming bugs could also return contradiction found. Hopefully, we won't have any of those. But my program does contain extensive validity checks to make sure that it's not going off the rails. The last thing that my solver can return is cannot proceed. This is when it's run all of its rules, it's proved every single cell that it can determine the status of, but yet there are still cells unknown. In that case, it hasn't reached a contradiction, hasn't reached a solution, it doesn't know how to keep going, so it's going to say, I can't proceed. Now, if I had a fully backtracking solver, then calling solve on the original grid instance would never return cannot proceed. Instead, once it got to the end of its analysis and got stuck, it would just guess a cell to be black or white, see if that led to a contradiction, and if it did, backtrack out and try another cell. However, even in a fully backtracking solver, cannot proceed is useful because you would not want to go through the whole chain of backtracking if you could avoid it. We'll see that later on in the solve method. And finally, we want to get some output out of my grid. Now, originally when I wrote this, I was simply printing to cout a grid in ASCII, so I would need to view it in monospace. Eventually, I wanted to emit something a little nicer to look at, HTML. And I also, because I care about analyzing the performance of this program, which we'll be looking at later, I wanted to keep all the HTML formatting that I had to do out of my timer calls. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to build up a data structure as I try to solve the grid, and then when someone calls write, I'm going to format up some HTML, write that out to wherever the user wants, and I'm not going to time that. It actually happens to be pretty fast, but since I'm not so interested in the speed of that, I would like to do that in a separate pass. So that's what write does. It takes an OStream reference. This is the part of the C++ standard library that I mentioned that is not part of the STL proper. This is IOStreams. In particular, I could write to cout, but because this is HTML, I would much rather write it to a file. So this will actually be sent to an OF stream, an output file stream. And it takes a couple longs, which is how I record times. So you'll notice that the interface of my class is very restricted. I can do very few things with it. That's because internally it's doing a lot of advanced analysis, but the user only needs to access a few member functions. So the majority of its code is private. This is usually good. You don't want to expose things in the public interface if the user doesn't logically need them. One thing that people new to C++ will often do is they'll add a data member to a class, and then they'll immediately add a getter and a setter, exposing that data member's existence to the world. Data member almost may as well be public, which is really bad. You don't want to do that. When you write a class, you want to think about, okay, I'm a user. I haven't written the class. I want to use the class. What interface do I need? And then you provide the interface to the user. You want to keep as many implementation details, things like data members, helper functions, things like that, private to the class so the user doesn't need to worry about them, and so that the user can't go break the class's invariance by accidentally calling member functions in the wrong order or in the wrong way. So that's why most of the stuff in my class is private. So I'm going to skip over that for now and show you what the main function looks like, because that is the best way to understand how a class works, is to see how it's used. So here's my main function. I've put it as early in the file as I could. Right before it, I've got these counter and frequency functions. There's many ways to do timing in Windows. My preferred method is to call query performance counter and query performance frequency. It's a very high resolution timer. Very accurate. There's other ways, using RDTSC to look at clock cycles, less accurate forms. I like UPC. So this simply returns longs, that is a count of ticks. Frequency returns how many ticks occur in a second. I can just divide and get seconds or milliseconds or whatever I want. Simple helper functions using stuff from Windows.h. And then in my main function, I have a try block. We'll see what I do with that. I record when my program's beginning, putting it in this long called start, and then I construct up my grid. Here's how the construction looks like. So I've got a grid which I call G. I tell it the width and height, the width of Wikipedia's, what I'm solving here is Wikipedia's example at the top. They call it moderately difficult. They're horrible liars. This thing is really hard to solve. And it's a 10 by 9 puzzle. So if I look at my program, I tell it the width is 10, the height is 9, and then I give it a string literal here, which has the content of the grid. Unknown cells are spaces, and known cells are numbers. At the beginning, we don't know any cells are white or black, so I have no other characters. And I need to indicate the end of a row with a new line. This is funny. This is a bug that my program initially had. At first, I didn't have these new lines there. It worked just fine until I tried to solve a grid which ended with a number at the end of the row, and then the next row began with a number. Because this is a single string literal, my parser saw a single number, like 21, instead of a separate 2 and 1. That's bad. So I break rows with this new line character here that my parser will correctly interpret. If you haven't seen what I'm doing here, C++ says, and C says this too, when you have string literals that are adjacent, in this case, here's a string literal, and immediately afterwards, another string literal, they are concatenated at compile time. It's as if I wrote it in a single long literal. This is useful when you've got something that's like 200 characters long and you want to break it so that it occupies a nice width in your editor. In this case, I'm working with a 2D string, so I really do want to take advantage of this. Of course, it all happens at compile time. Once I've constructed my grid, this is going to parse the string, initialize some data structures, then I'm going to call its solve member function repeatedly. So I'm going to say, while g.solve, I'm going to call that, and as long as it keeps returning this constant grid keep going, I'm going to just loop. The body of my loop is empty. When this loop terminates, solve returns something that's not keep going. It either said solution found, contradiction found, hopefully not that, or cannot proceed. And it will have recorded that in the HTML output, so I don't need to look at the return value. Then I stop my timer. I'm going to record the value of counter in finish, And then I'm going to construct an OF stream. That's an output file stream from the fstream header. And I'm going to write to output HTML. This will open for overwrite, so if the file doesn't exist, it'll be created. If it does exist, its contents will be overwritten. This is exactly how fopen behaves. In fact, ofstream translates pretty directly into a sequence of stdio.h calls. It's simply object-oriented using IO streams, so I don't need to worry about closing it. Then I'm going to call a member function write on the grid and have it write to the OF stream and tell it how long that it took with start and finish, so it can put that in the HTML. Now, I mentioned that I had a try-catch block. So if anything goes wrong in my solving, for example, the string is malformed, or if I encounter a logic error in my programming, I'll throw an exception. And then the try up here will intercept that exception, send it to the catch. If it is a std exception from the exception header, I'll catch that and I'll print out what went wrong. It'll say exception caught. It'll print it to the standard error stream, again using IO streams. Print out whatever message was in that exception and then return exit failure. Or if some exception object whose type I don't know is thrown, then this catch block dot 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 will activate and it'll say unknown exception caught. So no exceptions will leak from main. Now, of course, this is an example program. If I were writing a real program, I would want try-catch blocks at program boundaries. These are things obviously like main functions where exceptions can't leak through. It could also be I'm writing a DLL and all of my functions have to have C-like interfaces, so only talking about pointers and ints, no STL data structures. I can't let exceptions leak through such an interface, so in that case I need a try-catch block on every method exported by my DLL, non-member function exported by my DLL. Or if I'm writing a com object, I need to have my com methods returning H results and not exceptions. So I'd love to use exceptions internally, but when I reach my com function and I'm about to return to the user, I need a try-catch block there to translate exceptions that I used internally into H results or whatever error codes that I happen to be using. So that's where you should see try-catch blocks. If you're sprinkling try-catch blocks in little places throughout your code, you're probably doing something wrong. Exceptions are for non-local error recovery. So if you're trying to use them for local error recovery, executing a statement and then immediately putting a try-catch around it, you're either doing something probably not quite right, or you're using a function that has been misdesigned. The usual example is boost lexical cast, where if you try to parse something and it's malformed, it'll throw an exception. Often you don't want that. You'd want it to return a error code of some kind to immediately deal with it. So that's my main function. Now let's look at the data structure stored by my grid class in addition to all of its helper functions that we'll be going through. So when I look at my grid, I immediately start off with a helper enum called state. Now I mentioned that thing about underlying types. Here I'm using it. So I'm using an enum here. This is a little bit of C++ core language because I don't want to confuse the states that a cell can be in with other numbers like coordinates. An enum offers sort of one-way protection. You can't convert an integer to an enum. That's prohibited. But you can convert a value of an enumeration to an integer. And I actually want this because I'm going to store numbers that cells have been marked with in the enum. Now, there's a C++ LX feature that Visual Studio 2010 does not yet implement called strongly typed enums that prohibits that conversion so that you can't go from enums to integers or back without an explicit cast. I could use that if I had it available to me, but the original C++ 9803 enums satisfy my needs. So there's three named states that a cell can be in. A cell can be unknown. In this case, it's just blank. I don't know what the state of the cell is. Or it could be white. Murakami traditionally, when you're solving this by hand, marks this by putting a dot in the cell. That's a cell that's known to be white. Or a cell can be black, filled in like this, known to be part of the water, if you look at how the puzzle is explained. Cells can also have a state not shown here, meaning they contain a number. Like 7 or 3 or 2 or so forth. I'm going to want to store this in my enum, so I want to make sure that the enum is the size of an int. That's what this underlying type is. Enum state colon int means that the enum is the size of an int. I can store ints in it and I can get them back out. So this is great. And because all of the numbers in Nurikabi Puzzle are 1 or greater, I'm going to use negative numbers for the named values of my enumeration so they don't collide. So that's why they're -3, -2, and -1. The actual values don't matter. I'm never going to look at those values again. There's only one place where I care about the order of the values. We'll see what I do about that. But it is important that they're all less than 1. So then I have a private class, a nested class called Region. I could make this public, but users of Grid have no reason to talk about regions. I could put it in a detail namespace, and I might do that if I were in a header. But in this case, making it nested to my Grid class, it is exactly what I want. So I've exhaustively commented this file, so when you read the source code in full, you can read the comments and they explain what I'm doing. As I'm showing it to you here, I'm going to skip over the comments and sort of show you the highlights of what the class is doing. So imagine that I've got this puzzle, and I'm going to start off by solving it. Let me fill in a few simple cells. So one of the rules in Nurikabi is that cells that touch two numbers must be black, because these numbers cannot be joined into a single island. So I've got these three here. All the cells between them must be black, like this. Another rule is that all of the black cells in the final solution must be contiguous. So if there's ever an isolated black cell that cannot connect to others, the puzzle solution is invalid. So when I see a black cell that is surrounded by three wider numbered cells like this and has only one avenue of escape, what I call a liberty, if you play Go, you'll be familiar with this terminology, and I see other black cells in my solution, then I know that if this cell, let's imagine that it were white, then this black cell would be isolated. One important thing is that Nurikabi uses orthogonal adjacency, so left, right, up, down, diagonals are not considered adjacent. So if this cell were white, this black cell would be trapped and could never connect to these other black cells. The solution would be invalid. So when I see a cell that is bounded on three sides and has one unknown cell next to it, then I know that cell must be the same color. So this black region must expand. And I said region there because what I care about is connected segments of cells. Now, imagine that I'm just going to scribble some stuff here that's not necessarily the right solution. If we prove that this cell was white and this cell was white, now this region of two black cells would be confined if this one were white. So it's got to expand again. So now I'm looking at groups of cells. This group-based analysis is how my solver is going to solve this entire puzzle. Let me erase that. So I'm going to use a data structure, which I call class region, in order to remember which cells are connected to each other. In my original implementation of the solver, I didn't do this. I did purely cell-based analysis, and whenever I wanted to find out if a cell belonged to a contiguous chunk of cells, I did a flood fill by calling a function recursively and figuring out every cell that was connected to it. That was not only expensive in time, but it was also horrible to code. By storing this information in class region, I can do the processing essentially once, update my data structures, and then I can very easily, both in time and in code, ask, hey, you cell, what other cells are you connected to? So that's what class region does. Let's look at its data members. A region stores three data members. First, state. One of the things that I do in my program is I don't have unknown regions. Cells that are unknown are not tracked by this region machinery. I only have regions for black cells, white cells, and numbered cells. So that's what M state can be. It can either be black, white, or numbered. Then I also have a couple sets that these are sets of pair int int. What this means is that they're storing all of the coordinates, XY coordinates, that comprise the region. So M coords, imagine that I've got a region of two black cells here. This is what I'm doing. I have a comment in the file that mentioned this. I use an upper left based origin. So the x coordinates, which of course start at 0, look like this. And the y coordinates, which start at the upper left, look like this. So imagine that I had proven that these two cells are black, which they are. I'm going to have them a region data structure keeping track of this, and it's going to have a set whose M coords member contains x equals 7, y equals 4, and x equals 7, y equals 3. The other thing that it tracks is it tracks what unknown cells surround the region, because very often we want to ask, hey region, are you bordered by exactly one unknown cell, or two unknown cells, or that sort of thing, or no unknown cells? So that's what M unknowns is. in this case, this region here is bordered by three unknown cells, this one, and this one. So this set would have those coordinates. Now, the important thing about regions is not only do they remember which cells are connected, they also remember the case where you've proven that a white cell is connected to other cells. So let's go back to these threes here. We saw that the cells that touch these threes must be black. Now look at this three. If the cell below it were black, then this three would be confined, and it's saying that it needs to be part of an island of three cells. It can't be confined to a single cell. So it's got to expand down, same principle, this cell must be white. Now, even though this cell is white, we want to keep track of the fact that it's connected to an island that's going to be size 3. So the cell's state will be white, but the cell's region will be numbered, and that number will be 3. This is extremely important, and it's what makes the solver so powerful and efficient. So that's what state is. It has a bunch of helper functions, members. I keep the data members private because direct access to them is probably not a good idea. But I expose lots of ways to look at and modify the sets. Now, region is a nested class that's private to grid. So although I encapsulate region a little by making its data members private, grid is mostly expected to keep regions and variants correct. If I were writing this for consumption by users, it would probably have a somewhat different interface. So I've got a constructor. I can tell it a state, an X and a Y, and what unknowns border this cell's coordinate. Now, whenever I know that something must be impossible, I'm going to throw a logic error. There's other ways to do this. I could use asserts. Many people are fond of that. I myself use logic errors. There's some people who believe that throwing exceptions in the face of programming errors is a bug and that you should always use asserts. I'm in the camp that says it's okay to throw logic errors sometimes. But it is controversial. There are many people who disagree with me. So if you think that this is silly, then you can replace this with an assert. But one thing that I definitely want to verify, no matter how I go about it, is that I don't want to have regions whose state is unknown. So I can verify this in the constructor. If the state is unknown, I'm going to throw a logic error reporting what went wrong. And then after this, I know the state is known. And then I'll insert the coordinate. I have a bunch of functions that will return whether the region is white, black, numbered, what its number is, if it is numbered. Again, I've got basically an assertion here saying that you better not call number if the region does not have a number itself. And then you can do a bunch of operations on the region like iterating through its coordinates, iterating through its unknowns, adding coordinates to the region, and so forth. Grid is responsible for updating this bookkeeping data structure. So one of the things, let's see, we have a bunch of helper functions here. We'll see what they do below. Now, the most important part of grid is the data members. So here it's going to store its width and height because we're going to refer to them all the time. It's convenient to have them. It also calculates the total number of black cells that will be in the solution. This is makes some forms of analysis significantly simpler. There's comments that explain what's going on here. And finally, the sort of central part of its data structure is M underscore cells. Now, this looks kind of complicated if you haven't seen extensive use of the STL before, but it's what it's doing is actually very elegant. It's a vector-vector pair state-shared-putter-region, but what that means is the first part is vector of vector. That's a two-dimensional vector. So if I'm going to sketch this out, here's the first vector. This is M cells. Now, I'm skipping over a bunch of stuff like the fact that a vector is really a triple of three pointers that points to a block of memory. Here I'm just showing you the block of memory. I'm assuming that you understand that part. And it contains subvectors like this. Now, the STL doesn't require that all of these subvectors be the same size. This vector vectors could be ragged with different sizes for each of the subvectors. In this case, I want a rectangle, so I'm going to construct it so that they're all the same length. And then, what are the elements of my subvectors? Well, they're pairs, and every element is going to have two things, a state. So in my grid, I'm going to mark, say, this cell as being black, and this cell as being white, and this cell as being numbered with 3, and so forth. And it also has a shared pointer to region. So this is that bookkeeping data structure that I was mentioning. If I've got a cell here that's marked to be white and a cell that's marked to be 3, they're going to belong to the same region. So I'm going to have a single region data structure sitting in memory. that's got its state and M chords and M unknowns that we saw. And W and 3 are going to have shared pointers to the same object. And as we saw, because it's a region that's eventually going to occupy 3 cells, it's going to be numbered with 3, and it's going to have sets that say I have this coordinate and this coordinate, and I'm bounded by whatever unknown cells. Same with the black cells, they're going to have their own regions, but the unknown cells do not. I've got a comment here that says that if the state is unknown, the shared pointer region member is going to be empty. So if I want to access a cell in constant time, remember, thinking about asymptotic complexity is very useful. I could say m underscore cells, which is a vector of vectors, and I've arranged it so that the first axis is the x-coordinate, and then so that's getting me a subvector. Then I say y, this gets me an element of the subvector, and this is a pair. So if I say dot first, this is the state of the cell. If I say dot second, this is the shared putter. Second. And then I can ask it, okay, are you black? Are you white? Are you numbered? What is your beginning iterator of your set, and so forth. I have helper functions because I don't want to be saying this all the time. Instead, I can simply say cell of xy, and this expands to this. Then the other thing that my grid keeps track of is the set of all regions. Now, some parts of analysis want to look at individual cells. They want to ask, okay, is this cell part of a region? One simple form of analysis is if I say, I'm just going to scribble in here, 3 black cells, then pools are prohibited in the solution, so this cell must be white. This is a cell-based analysis. Other forms of analysis want to look at regions. They're going to look at a whole region and say, is this region bounded by a single unknown cell? Is it complete? Is it bounded by 2 unknown cells? Are they diagonal? That sort of thing. So I'm going to want to iterate through all of the regions, and so what I do is I keep a set of shared putter to region. And what this is imagine that I've got a region here. This region is marked as black. Maybe I've got another separate black region pointed to by some other cell. I've got a white region that is not yet known to be connected to a number. Suppose that these are the regions that I've discovered so far. Then my set of shared putter to region called M regions is going to allow me to iterate through just these regions in a linear time. Now, set, as we saw in part 2, is automatically sorted. In this case, it's sorted by shared putter, and that comparator is going to compare the addresses of the regions. I actually don't care about the ordering. I simply want to go through all of the regions, but the fact that I can look up, is this region in this set in logarithmic time is very convenient. And the fact that I can add and remove regions in logarithmic time is convenient. There's probably a few places in my solver where I could be using vector instead of set, but I use set very extensively. The other thing that set enforces is uniqueness, and you'll see this all the time with coordinates. Suppose that I am walking through my analysis, and I determine that a cell is black through a couple of mechanisms. For example, suppose that I've got, I'm just going to draw a tiny grid here, a couple of one cells that are like this. Then any cell that's next to a one cell must be black. In this case, this one's next to 2 one cells. So I could add it to my mark as black data structure twice. But I only want to actually add it once. Set will enforce uniqueness if I've got a set pair int-int. And that's exactly what I want. So that's why I use set extensively. Finally, I've got a member called sitrep. This is set to keep going, but if I encounter a contradiction, my solver needs to remember this. The easiest thing to do is put it in a data member rather than trying to pass it out through a bunch of functions. So that's why it's a member. And finally, I mentioned that as we're solving the grid, we build up a record of what we've done and then convert it into HTML later. That's what mOutput is. As we discover that a bunch of cells have changed, we push into this vector. In this case, I do care about the sequence. It's a tuple. Tuple is a generalization of pair. It's a pair with n number of elements, in this case, 3 elements. The first thing that I store is a string saying what happened, like, oh, I found complete islands. Awesome. The next is a two-dimensional vector of states. This is just a copy of the new state of the grid. I don't care about regions when I'm printing the HTML, so that's why it's not a pair of state shared putter region. And the last thing is I need to know what cells are updated because I want to highlight them. So that's what the third member is, set pair int int. That is a set of coordinates of cells that changed. And then that will be converted to HTML. Let me show you what that looks like. So what I print out, I just open it in my browser. It prints out its initial state. Here I'm using CSS to style it nicely. Cells that are white have a white background, same with numbers. Cells that are unknown are this light gray. Cells that are proved to be black or dark gray. I thought this was pretty visible. And so here's an example. When it finds complete islands, which is the simplest form of analysis, here's a one that's complete. So it's got to be surrounded by black cells. It marks them. Here I've just put a hash to indicate that it's black. And it prints out a message saying complete islands found. The next thing that it prints out is it finds that this black cell in the corner it has only one unknown cell adjacent to it, and it must expand. So in that case, the cell above it must be marked as black. So whenever a black cell is newly marked, I highlight it with teal, which kind of looks like dark gray. Then on subsequent printing outs, it remains dark gray to indicate that I've already proven its state. When I find that a cell is white, then I'm going to highlight it with yellow, and then on subsequent printings out, it's going to remain white. And I do all of this in my print member function, and I actually display this with CSS. That's a very simple. You don't need to know HTML to know how this works. So that is an overview of how my solver works. I'll post the code in full so that you can read through it. I sort of view programming as a solitary activity. You know, you sit in your office and you write a bunch of code, and then you go share it with other people. But when you're writing code, you really want to think about it in depth because code is complicated. Even when you're using powerful libraries, the problems that you're trying to solve are usually at the very limit of your abilities as a programmer. So there's almost no replacement for reading the code in full, seeing how it works, sort of stepping through it mentally in your head, if not in a debugger, and understanding how all the pieces fit together. So I've given you an overview of how the data members, what they mean. The comments are relatively exhaustive, so they should explain what the analysis is doing. The solve member function is rather large. I could have broken it up into smaller functions to do piece by piece, but in this case, doing it as a single large function seemed to make the most sense to me. And try to see if you can figure out what's going on, how my solver works, and how it manages to solve the entire example from Wikipedia, and eventually print, I'm done. So, homework problem for you, in addition to understanding how the solver works, if you wrote your own solver after part three, you can compare how yours works against mine. What I'd like you to think about is the performance. So you can see here, I print out how long it takes me to solve this entire grid. Initially, my solver took about 128 milliseconds with maximum optimizations on my Q9450, which is my work machine. And then I found some redundant work that I was doing. This is the cache member if you look at the code. And I was able to reduce this to about 87 milliseconds, which is very fast, I think. But further improvements are possible. In fact, I've identified probably at least three things that I could be doing to increase the speed of my solver significantly. In experiments, I've already increased its speed by about half, and I see a couple other ways to increase its speed even further. So I'd like you to look at the code and think about potential ways to speed it up or to make it more powerful, to handle other grids. You can throw other Nurikabi grids at the solver and see if it solves them, or see if it encounters a place where it gets stumped and can't proceed any further. Or you might even find a bug, although I don't believe that they'll be easy to find. So in the next part, I'll go through how solve works in detail. We'll see a lot of uses of the STL and things that we haven't covered yet, like regex and a few STL algorithms. So see you then.